This is Mind Bites, a series for Philosophy Bites with me, David Edmonds.
And me, Nigel Warburton.
Philosophers have long tried to make sense of consciousness. How can our subjective experience be accounted for in an objective physical world? But there's another puzzle about consciousness. Why do we have it? What purpose does it serve? A question for the neuroscientist, Chris Frith.
Chris Frith, welcome to Mind Bites.
Hi.
The topic we're going to focus on is, what's the point of consciousness? Let's just begin by getting clear what you mean by consciousness.
I mean our subjective experience, what we're aware of from moment to moment. So I'm not talking about whether we're awake or asleep. I'm talking about what we're aware of when we're awake. And I think the critical thing to bear in mind from lots of recent research is how much influences our behaviour, which we never become aware of, both in terms of the things in front of us and what we're actually doing.
So I can see the trees outside the window. I'm aware of seeing the trees. I'm somehow representing those trees, I guess, to myself. And I can talk to you about that.
Yes, that's exactly the point. I mean, there's a strange paradox about consciousness. On the one hand, we tend to believe that it's a completely private space, so I can never somehow get access to your consciousness and you can never get access to mine. On the other hand, it's the only part of our mental life that we can actually talk to each other about.
I was intrigued by what you were saying about how much of our mental life is unconscious or preconscious. Could you just say a bit more about that?
Well, in visual perception, which is the most widely studied area, for example, if you present someone with a fearful face, then you see all sorts of physiological activity in the brain of the observer reflecting that they are also slightly afraid. But you will get this result even if the fearful face is presented so briefly that the person seeing it is not aware of what the expression was. So in this case, the emotional expression has been processed, has produced a physiological response without the person ever being aware of that happening.
So this is very relevant to what we're talking about, because it means that a lot of what is being processed by our brains is not available to our consciousness. So why did we evolve with this capacity to reflect on some aspects of our mental life?
Well, of course, some people, and it goes back at least as far as Thomas Huxley, think that consciousness is purely an epiphenomenon, has no function. He actually said it has as much function on the human behaviour as the steam whistle of an engine has on the workings of the engine. What he forgot about in this metaphor is that the steam whistle of the engine has a considerable effect on the workings of other engines.
Epiphenomenalism, then, is this idea that we do have consciousness, but it doesn't have any causal role to play for us. It just sort of reports on stuff. It doesn't actually lead to action.
Yes, and also there's this concept of the philosophical zombie, which they think shows that it is possible to have an entity which behaves exactly like human beings in every possible respect, but is having absolutely no conscious experience. Now, I don't believe in this, because I believe that consciousness has evolved because human beings seem to have a much richer inner mental life than other creatures. And if it has evolved, it must be giving us some sort of advantage. So I believe that if there is such a thing as a human who is having no conscious experience, they would not actually be able to produce all the behaviour that the rest of us can produce.
So there's still this question, though, what possible role could consciousness play? One might be that it allows us to reflect before we act. That's quite a common belief.
Yes, this is very interesting, and I put it slightly differently and say it allows us to reflect after we act. Most people know of this famous experiment originally performed by Benjamin Libet, where he was asking people to make spontaneous responses, and he also asked them to indicate when they had the spontaneous urge to lift their finger, as it actually was what they were doing, and showed that you got distinct patterns of brain activity before lifting the finger, and also before they reported having the urge to lift their finger. And more recent studies with magnetic resonance imaging have managed to predict when the finger will be lifted up to 6 seconds before the person has reports having the urge to lift the finger. Some people interpret this as showing that we have no control, no conscious control over our actions, at least of this simple kind. But nevertheless, it's the case that we have vivid experience of agency, as it's sometimes called. That is to say, we have the vivid experience that I am causing something to happen in the world by my actions, and we also have this very vivid experience that I could have done something else. And this feeling, this strong feeling that I could have done something else, is what leads to the bitter emotional experience of regret.
So are you suggesting that regret is somehow a misguided category, that it somehow doesn't map onto the way that our brains actually work?
No, I don't think so. I think this ability to reflect on our experiences and talk to other people about them has an important function. At the same time, sort of paradoxically again, on the one hand, we're very keen to tell people why we did things and explain our behaviour. On the other hand, these reflections are extremely malleable, by which I mean that we can be completely misguided when we explain why we did things. And there's this very beautiful series of experiments from Petter Johansson and colleagues in Sweden. In the first experiment, they had packs of cards, which were actually pictures of female faces in two packs, left and right. And they were shown the pair, and they were asked to say, which one do you prefer? They said, I prefer the one on the left. And the experimenter would put the pack down, give them the one they had just chosen, and say, can you explain now why you prefer this one? And the trick, because if it's a psychology experiment, there's always a trick, was that sometimes they actually showed them the face that they had not chosen. And again, most of the time, the participants would then proceed to explain why they had chosen this face. So in this case, they're giving justification for something that they haven't actually done. So in a sense, it's the justification is more important than the act.
But does that suggest that our mental life is a kind of confabulation, that it's a retrospective retelling of events to make a coherent story rather than something that reports what actually happened?
I think that is true to some extent, but what I think is interesting is that it's precisely the business about talking to other people about what we have just done. And I think through talking to other people, we actually come up with sometimes actually a better way of understanding our behaviour and being more accurate in the way we describe how we make decisions. And even if it's not more accurate, we come up with a consensus about how decisions should be made.
Well, you're an experimental psychologist. Presumably, you don't just deal in hypotheses. There must be some kind of way of testing this.
Well, there are various aspects of this. If I could go back a bit, go back to talking about sensory perception rather than action, because, of course, we're not just able to report about what we have just done and why we've done it. We're also able to report about what we have just seen and how confident we are in that is what we just saw. And with some very clever colleagues, I have been involved in experiments in which two people are asked to perceive the same stimulus, and we make it rather difficult so that they are wrong, say, 25% of the time, and they both see the stimulus, they both say whether it was there or not, and then if they disagree, they have to discuss what they have seen and come up with a joint decision. And as long as they're both relatively equally competent, their joint decision is significantly better than the better one on their own. So that's showing that at least in these circumstances, two heads are better than one. But the critical point is that this depends on the discussion that they have. And the discussion that they have is largely concerns how confident were they in what they saw. And they have to calibrate each other. They have to come up with a way of telling each other how confident they are. And they use quite complicated verbal scales with many levels. And they have to calibrate each other so that when I say I'm quite confident, it means the same as what you say when you're quite confident. Whereas, as we know, in fact, in England, I think quite confident means not very confident. In America, quite confident means very confident indeed. So you have to do this calibration, which depends on this discussion of your subjective experiences. So this is an example of where this discussion is actually producing some advantage.
We've talked about perception and how the subtle ways in which people interact collaboratively, understanding what they're perceiving, can show us things about consciousness. What about agency?
Our sense of agency, I think, is one of the more vivid conscious subjective experiences. But this is also somewhat malleable. And the sense of agency, again, is something you can talk to other people about. You can ask people, how much do you think you were in control? And, of course, the liberty experiment itself depends critically on people being able to say, this was the exact time when I had the intention to move. So this is a very important part of conscious experience. And Patrick Haggard and colleagues have very cleverly devised a method for having an objective correlate of the sense of agency, which he calls intentional binding, because one aspect of agency is that I make perform an action which causes an outcome. And you can ask people, when did you perform the action and when did the outcome occur, using Libet's technique. And you can show that the more you feel you're in control, the closer together these two events are perceived subjectively to be.
One reading of Libet's experiments is that they've shown, or he's brought into question, the idea that human beings have free will. Because effectively what happens is that they perform actions and initiate those actions long before their intentions have kicked in the brain.
Yes, there are two aspects of that. I'm still on the fence as to whether we really have free will, but I certainly think that believing that we have free will is very important because of its relationship with responsibility and social cohesion. And also the belief that we have free will does seem to have effects on our behaviour. So there's a slew of experiments around these days asking what happens to people if you tell them that they don't have free will, which you do by saying Francis Crick, who's the most clever scientist around, wrote this thing saying all sensible people now know that free will doesn't exist. If you tell people they don't have free will and they believe you, then they're more likely to cheat in exams, they have become more selfish, and more compelling to me is that their behaviour in reaction time tasks changes. So normally in reaction time tasks you slow down after you make an error, which is due to some monitoring of your behaviour and taking account of this, and you get less slowing down after you've been told that free will doesn't exist, presumably because they have lost their faith in top-down control. And it even changes the amplitude of the readiness potential in the brain, which of course is what Libet was measuring in his famous anti-free will task. I think this is fascinating because basically this is an example of top-down control, what people tells you influencing how your brain works, which I think is what free will is all about. So that telling people they don't have free will actually demonstrates that we do.
But isn't all this compatible with the idea that the mind, the conscious mind, is an epiphenomenon?
No, I don't think so. This experience of agency, I think, actually has important consequences. So, for example, it's very much tied with the sense of responsibility. So most people in the West, if you ask the man in the street, as is now done by experimental philosophers, they will tell you that people are less responsible for actions that are not carried out consciously, and that there's a role for consciousness in responsibility. It ties responsibility to action. And, of course, it also, once you bring in responsibility, and there's some suggestion that the intentional binding in the agency will be increased if its responsibility is involved, you also bring in punishment, because, again, in the West, we would punish people who do things deliberately to a greater extent than those who do it accidentally. And again, we've studied people playing these economic games like trust, where you have free riders who take the money and run, as it were. That is a disaster for the community, and people stop investing their money. You can bring back community investment by introducing what they call altruistic punishment, which basically means you're allowed to punish the free riders. And that brings back the social cohesion, but it's critical to this punishment that you have to believe that they're responsible for their actions. So one idea that our consensus, which may not be accurate as to how the brain works, that people are responsible for their actions has a crucial role in producing social cohesion.
And consciousness, because it allows us to talk about our mental states and whether we did intend or felt that we intended something, is a prerequisite for this kind of social interaction.
Yes, that's what I believe. And as I was saying, it's very malleable. So you get things happening both ways. What you learn from your parents and from your peers about what is the right way to behave is actually filtering down and affecting the way your brain works. And likewise, what you say to other people in the long term can be changing this social consensus. So it critically depends on this two-way traffic, which I think consciousness, or sometimes called explicit metacognition, allows. So on the one hand, there are things coming up from the brain, from the unconscious. There are signals coming in which we learn how to interpret and talk to other people about. On the other hand, what people say to us is filtering down back into the system and altering the way we behave.
Would it then be fair to summarise your answer to the question, what is the point of consciousness, as this? That the point of consciousness is it's evolved as a way that has facilitated our social interactions in various ways to make us better at performing in groups. Individual consciousness is something which allows us to connect with other people, not something that keeps us apart from them.
You know, I would absolutely agree. What allows us to connect, and in a sense it's the critical bridge between culture and the individual person.
So in a sense it's overturned that metaphor of the mind as a prison. It's actually the thing that gets us out of prison.
Yes, and I believe, like all the things that seem to be problematic in our thought about consciousness, is due to Descartes, who was wrong again.
Chris Frith, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Mind Bites was made in association with the Meaning for the Brain and Meaning for the Person project, funded by the Arts and Humanities Research Council. For further information about the project, go to www.nicholasshea.co.uk. That's Shea, S-H-E-A.
For more Philosophy Bites and how to support us, please go to www.philosophybites.com.